Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint everybody, but it's Graham Laycock here actually today, along with John Axtell. Hello, John.
Hello, Graham.
And how are you?
I'm fine. Excited by all of the things that have been happening over at NASA.
I know, and you're going to give us an insight on that, I know. So you see what I did there?
I did.
But it's just amazing what's been achieved, isn't it? And what a difficult mission, and so far, so good. And the pictures look stunning.
They do indeed. So, yes, we had a splendid landing from the InSight spacecraft. It came down into a relatively smooth area of Mars. Called Elysium Planitia, which is a mixture of Latin and Greek, I think, meaning the plains of peace, which gives the idea of it being rubble-free, relatively.
I guess they spent a lot of time deciding where they wanted to land it.
Very much so, very much so indeed. Particularly as this mission is going to be doing something that we just haven't done before, and that's peer into the centre of Mars as far as they can. Scientists are really excited about this mission because we have lots of theories about the formation of planets, and of course we can study one of those up close, our Earth. Trouble with Earth is it has what we call plate tectonics. The continents move about, bang into one another. The crust gets subducted and melted. So the early evidence that there might have been gets melted on our planet. That's not going to be the case on Mars.
So there are no plates on Mars then?
No, it doesn't have any plate tectonics at all. As far as we understand.
As far as they know, anyway. Yes.
Well, some of the evidence is there. When you look at geothermal activity here on Earth, you get these huge plumes of magma coming up from the liquid core, and those will form islands as they come out in the Pacific, let's say, and you get an island form, and then the vent closes. Then it wells up and opens up again, and more stuff comes out, forms another island, because with plate tectonics, the crust has moved. Now, on Mars,
yes,
they have these plumes, and the same sort of thing happens, but it happens one on top of another, on top of another, on top
right.
of another. And we have these massive shield volcanoes on Mars, like the biggest one is called Olympus Mons, and it's enormous. It dwarfs Everest, but it's layer
keeps
upon
building.
Layer upon
yeah.
layer.
So
the plume doesn't move.
Right, okay. So they, and I understand that they're going to drill down in towards the
That's
core.
That's the idea.
How far down can they get?
I think with this one, I think it's 5 meters is what they right. what they hope. And that's where, you might have wondered, Graham, where the name InSight comes from.
Yes, it was. I was wondering.
It does sound a bit odd, doesn't it, as the name of the mission. And as far as I can remember, I'm sure they all sit around for ages batting around different names. But it stands for internal. That's the IN, exploration. They somehow have missed the exploration out of the name.
Right.
But then you get the SI, that's for seismic. G for geodesic. And the HT is heat transfer. And that's what this drill is for. They're going to drill down, 3 to 5 meters, measure the flow of heat between top and bottom,
right.
or rather, from below to
yes.
above.
Yes, yeah, sure.
Now, Mars will definitely have had a liquid core of molten iron, stuff like that, in the past, but has it still?
Right.
We don't know. Mm. We know that Mars has largely lost its magnetic field, and if it had a rotating dynamo in the centre, as the Earth does, it would have a stronger magnetic field than
right.
it does. But maybe there's a vestigial one. We don't know, but that's the sort of thing that scientists, as I say, are so excited about.
Have they
about.
Got a timescale for all this, how long it's going to doing all this?
Yes, it's not going to be quick. The probe is now down. It's starting to think about deploying its instruments. And I think the lifetime of the probe is something of the order 2 to 3 years for all of the experiments. It's a solar-powered one, so that was one of the first things, although they knew from the very first photograph that it was down safely, and they took a photograph, you may remember, from the underside of the lander. But a lot of people wondered, well, why is that camera producing such a dirty image? But that was expected. It was planned, in fact. There's a lens cap on that camera, but they thoughtfully made it a translucent lens cap, so it can see through it. And the reason for leaving the lens cap on was as it comes down, it kicks up a lot of dust. So that's what you see all over that lens for that very first picture. The later pictures were taken from different cameras on the top of the craft, and hence they were, you know, nice and clear. But the very first thing they had to do in terms of knowing that the craft was going to work was to wait until the solar panels had unfurled and had started charging up. Because without that, the craft's as good as dead, and it will all have been a sad waste of time. But getting to Mars is, oh, sorry, what I should have said was we were talking about how long it's going to take and what it's doing now. It has to deploy its instruments onto the surface of Mars. They're no good just on the lander. It needs to detect tremors, Mars quakes, impacts of micrometeors, all the way up to impacts of asteroids. Because if people are going to live there one day, they need to know, how often do asteroids come down? And we've all seen The Martian, you know, the film and so on. So they want to know about impacts, about upsets to the surface. And one of the instruments was made at Imperial College, so London is up there on Mars, as well as I am.
I'm going to say you're up there, aren't you? Your name's on this. You're famous.
Yes, my name is one of 2.5 million people.
It's nice that you're recognising this way, John.
That were
and nobody said you should be sent to Mars then.
Well, maybe a few people have thought that. Yeah, it was just a publicity stunt and a bit of fun. I understand that the sensitivity of one of these micro-seismometers is down to the level of the vibration of an atom it can pick up.
Really?
It's sensitive.
It's going to really detect then anything, you know, any tremor on Mars overall?
That's right.
That's what they reckon. Absolutely. over the whole planet.
Yeah.
Wow.
So all of these instruments, because of that's the sort of thing they're due to do, have to be deployed onto the surface of the planet rather than being on the lander. So they've got a grapple. It's a bit like one of those arms that you see in a fairground.
I know.
Picks up the cuddly toys.
I hope it works a bit better than ones I use.
Absolutely, yes. You don't want to drop it halfway through the hatch. No, this one is a five-finger prong that locks into position on the top of these instruments, lifts them off the lander and places them on the ground. So the first activities are to survey the ground. You don't want to be putting it down on top of a boulder. So they've got to make sure they know exactly where they're going to be positioning these things. But getting to Mars is a really difficult job. I know we've had tremendous successes with spacecraft, like, well, the first American success of Viking 1 and Viking 2 way back in 76. The very first one to land on Mars was Mars 3, launched in 71 by the Soviets. But that has been the last Russian success. Everything else they've launched has crashed or failed to get there. Many American ones have failed. Britain has failed. We landed Beagle 2 on Mars in 2003. In fact, it landed successfully, we now know, but one of the four solar panels, failed to open properly, got caught on a rock. So it could be working.
Yes, you go all that way and get caught on a rock.
I know, it's such a shame. Schiaparelli, the European one, ploughed in at a great rate of knots only 2 years ago. So, in fact, more than half of the spacecraft launched to Mars haven't made it. So the odds were actually against this one. It really is difficult to get to Mars. And I don't think we can do better than to listen to Rob Manning, the chief engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, explaining all of the steps that InSight had to go through before it could be successfully landed.
The process to get from the top of the atmosphere of Mars to the surface, we call entry, descent, and landing, or EDL. It takes thousands of steps to go from the top of the atmosphere to the surface, and each one of them has to work perfectly to be a successful mission. The process starts well above the top of the atmosphere of Mars. The crew stage faces the sun. It also has its radio antenna, which faces Earth. But now we don't need the crew stage. Its job is done. The next step, just 7 minutes before arriving to the top of the Mars atmosphere, is to separate the crew stage. Before you hit the top of the atmosphere, though, the space capsule has to orient itself so that the heat shield is precisely facing the atmosphere. Now the fun begins. The vehicle is moving at nearly 13,000 miles an hour, but it's hitting the top of the atmosphere at a very shallow angle, 12 degrees. Any steeper, the vehicle will hit the thicker part of the atmosphere and will melt and burn up. Any shallower, the vehicle will bounce off the atmosphere of Mars. At the very top of the atmosphere, it's about 70 miles above the surface of Mars, and the air is starting to get thicker and thicker and thicker. As it does that, the temperature on the heat shield gets well over 1,000 degrees centigrade, enough to melt steel. Over the next 2 minutes, the vehicle decelerates at a backbreaking 12 Earth Gs, from 13,000 miles an hour to about 1,000 miles an hour. At about 10 miles above the surface of Mars, a supersonic parachute is launched out of the back of the vehicle. 15 seconds after the parachute inflates, it's time to get rid of the heat shield. Six pyrotechnic devices fire simultaneously, allowing the heat shield to fall and tumble away from the vehicle, exposing the lander to the surface of Mars. 10 seconds after the heat shield is dropped, three pyrotechnically deployed legs are released and locked for landing. About a minute later, the landing radar is turned on, sending pulses toward the surface of Mars as the vehicle starts to try to measure how high it is above the surface and how fast it's going. At about a mile above the surface of Mars, the lander falls away from the back shell and lights its engines. And very quickly, the vehicle must rotate out of the way so that the parachute and the back shell doesn't come down to hit it. The last thing that has to happen is that on the moment of contact, the engines have to shut down immediately. If they don't, the vehicle will tip over. So if all the steps of entry, descent, and landing happen perfectly, and we are safely on the surface of Mars, we'll be ready to do some exciting new science.
Well, it's fascinating technology, isn't it? Very, very clever, John.
Indeed.
And there's more to come for Mars, isn't there?
There is. Although InSight is the current mission, obviously, for NASA, the planning is well underway and build is well underway for their next mission, which at the moment just has the name Mars 2020. There will be a proper mission name selected for it ere long. So that's due for launch in July 2020 and will land in February 2021. And that one, they've just announced at NASA the landing site. It's a crater called Jezero. Now, the purpose of this one, quite different from InSight, is to search for signs of past microbial life. And also to test some new landing technologies. This one is going to be able to choose its own path as it lands. As it comes in, it won't be a ballistic trajectory like InSight was. It'll follow basically a ballistic path, but it will compare its database, onboard database, with images it's taken, radar images, of where it's coming down, and be able to shift its direction as it's coming down through the atmosphere.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, we've got driverless cars, so
it's getting that way. Yes, next they'll have Uber on Mars. what's so interesting about their landing choice is Jezero, this crater, is at a what seems to have been an old river delta. So there's a large riverbed, a former riverbed, leading into what used to be, so we believe, a lake. And Jezero Crater is on top of a pile that just looks like the Nile Delta, that sort of thing. Lots of channels with a delta that's built up from silt that's been carried down. So that would be a prime place to discover, are there any traces? Because this crater is plums right on top of this layer of silt, and so will have gouged out quite deeply into that area. So that's going to be interesting, but it won't be alone. It will be flying through space and landing on Mars in company with one from Europe. Now, this one is called ExoMars, and it's ExoMars 2020. It actually launches a month later than the NASA one, in August 2020, and lands a month later, March 2021. And they have just selected their landing place. The working group have decided that a place called Oxia Planum is the landing site. And it's similar to the American one. It's going to search for biosignatures of past microorganism. And Oxia Planum lies at a boundary area where many channels, past river channels, it's believed, fed into vast lowland plains. Now, there's also a European spacecraft, Mars Express, there's two going around there, one NASA, one European. They have shown that this particular area is rich in clay-rich minerals. So there's lots of layers of these in the soil there. So you can only get clay-rich sort of areas formed in water. And this is believed to be something like 4 billion years ago. So not expecting to find live microorganisms, but that would be great. But they're looking to see, you know, have there been some in the past? So twin missions. That's also, I mentioned the Russians earlier. That's European Space Agency working in partnership with Roscosmos, the Russian Space Agency. The spacecraft will be launched from Baikonur on a Russian launcher. Whilst we're at Mars, because one of the things that people will remember is our Curiosity rover, which is going great guns, but there's been another little hero of a rover called Opportunity. Now, that has been silent since the 10th of June. This was launched, I think it was 2003, or rather landed in 2003. Launched 2003, I've checked now, landed 2004. Its design life was for 90 days, or as they call them, because it's a Martian day, is a bit longer than one of ours, a sol. It actually lasted 5,111 in active mode.
It's done very well, isn't it?
So that is fantastic. Mm. So it's exceeded its design life 55 times over. It's roved 28 miles in that time as well. But sadly, back in June, there was a planet-wide dust storm, and it's covered its solar panels in dust. Now, it had been hoped that that would dissipate, and indeed the storms have dissipated, but it seems as though there's still too much dust on the panels for it to power up again. Hopefully, maybe a wind will come along and blow a bit off, but nothing yet. So far, they've sent 253 wakey-wakey calls to it, but with no response. So they do think it's probably a little bit of a goner. Such is a sad life, but didn't it do well?
Indeed. It's very lucky you didn't get that dust storm a long time ago.
Now, whilst we think of Mars, that often makes people think of SpaceX, Elon Musk, because he has said in the past he would like to move to Mars. Remember his quote, he said he'd actually like to die on Mars, but just not on impact. He's reiterated that wish in a recent tweet, and he says it's 70% likely that he will be going to Mars. But he's reiterated that point. Life on Mars is going to be hard, and we will probably not come back. It's a one-way trip. Now, the thing that he wants to go to Mars in has up until now been called the Big F, well, BFR, Big F Rocket, and left us to try and work out what the F stood for.
Flipping.
It could well be, or Falcon was also suggested, amongst others. By tweet, he's announced that it's been renamed Starship. Now, that is the... that's a good name, isn't it?
Going boldly.
Now, that's the main part, the spaceship-looking part that is meant to carry up to 100 passengers in some configurations. The second part of it, the booster, is to be called Super Heavy. Now, you remember that SpaceX main rocket is called Falcon 9, but there is Falcon Heavy as well, so this one is to be called Super Heavy. Now, talking of Mars and SpaceX, you'll remember, of course, Graham, that when Falcon Heavy had its maiden launch, it launched one of his Tesla sports cars.
Indeed.
together with a mannequin called Starman. That has now actually passed Mars. Well, not Mars the planet, but it's passed the path that Mars takes around the Sun. So it's gone beyond Mars orbit. They've carried on their usual commercial success. They've launched a satellite for a Middle Eastern organisation using a Falcon 9 that had been previously flown up to orbit, had been landed vertically, refurbished. But for the first time, they've launched this from Vandenberg Air Force Base and landed again at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Now, they've launched from California before rather than Florida, but this is the first time that they've gone for a landing at California. So they're expanding their capabilities, not just from the East Coast in Florida across to the West Coast. They've also announced very recently that the version of their Dragon mission, which is the craft that takes supplies up to the International Space Station, they've got a version of that will be manned. That's called Crew Dragon. Now, they've just announced that the first flight of Crew Dragon will be on January the 7th next year. But that will be an unmanned flight, just a proving flight. NASA requires that before it puts astronauts in there.
Maybe a mannequin?
you never know with Elon Musk, but it's going to be an unmanned test, as I say, to the ISS. But it will go through all of the docking procedures, the undocking procedures, the return to Earth, the landing, the recovery, just to prove it. Mind you, it did amuse me. Elon Musk has brought a little bit of a problem to SpaceX because you might remember fairly recently he was smoking marijuana at an interview in California where it's legal. But NASA have taken a dim view of this. And so they've announced a drug check across all of their commercial suppliers to make sure that people aren't smoking pot whilst on duty and so on. So that's a going across Boeing and across SpaceX as well. So no doubt Musk's employees will be less impressed.
Indeed, yes. We don't get going too high in the sky.
Indeed. Let's go on a little bit further out in our solar system now. You might remember, Graham, I talked to David a few times about a visitor from another solar system. This was called Oumuamua. And to start with, people weren't sure whether it was an asteroid, rocky, or whether it was a comet, mainly icy. And the feeling was it probably was a comet, had a cometary characteristics rather than an asteroid. It's on its way out of the solar system now, having visited, and will leave us. However, there was a slight anomaly. People were tracking its path, and they noticed that the object deviated slightly from that trajectory.
Yes, and a speculation was there somebody on board.
A group of people at Harvard have said, okay, so other scientists are saying, well, that could be caused by outgassing, which as it passed the sun, it picked up energy from the sun, heated up, and so gases, volatiles have been released, and that has added a little bit of thrust. But they're saying you shouldn't also discount the theory that it could have been perhaps a light sail powered craft, where you have a big canopy of material, thin material, that picks up the solar wind and uses the power of light to project it. So I personally don't think that's the case, but it's interesting that it was Harvard scientists that were actually saying that you shouldn't discount this sort of thing.
Interesting.
Time will tell. Still in our solar system, but right in the centre, we've got the Parker Solar Probe. That is launched by NASA not that long ago, and is underway to be the its eventual position will only be 4 million miles from the sun at its closest approach, but that won't be until 2024. But the Parker Solar Probe has just broken two previous records. Both of those were set by another sun-studying spacecraft called Helios 2, but that was way back in 76. So it's become the closest spacecraft to the sun. It reached 15 million miles from the sun on this particular pass, whereas the closest Helios got was 25 million miles. It's also the fastest ever spacecraft. Helios got to 153,000. Parker has just done 213,200. So that is shifting. It got to Venus, having been launched from Earth, in just 6 weeks.
Wow.
And that is, goodness knows how many million miles, I'm not sure, in terms of the total journey time. But of course it was using Venus to slow it down. The sun's gravitational force would pull the probe in, so it was using Venus to slow it down. That slung it into an orbit. It'll return. I think it comes back to Earth once to use us again as a brake, and Venus again, and then about five or six flybys Mercury to get it into the exact orbit that will bring it to its stop position, as I say, about 4 million miles from the sun. So interesting times for Parker. And of course, I mentioned, Graham, that I'm on Mars. One of my avatars is on Mars.
Yeah.
Another one is on the Parker Solar Probe.
You're everywhere, aren't you?
I'm getting about.
You're throughout the universe.
And given the heat on the Parker Solar Probe when it's near Mars, but it, you know, it's very cold on Mars, minus 100, minus 150 or so.
I hope well wrapped up.
Yeah, well, on average, I'm comfortable, I would say. Okay. Let's go outside our solar system now to one of our near neighbours. This is called Barnard Star. One of our closest neighbours, it's only 6 light-years away. The nearest stars are, of course, Proxima and Alpha Centauri, you know, for just over 4.5 light-years away. Now, Barnard Star has a very high proper motion. It's speeding past us quite noticeably. It moves through what's called 10 arc seconds per year. So that's quite a significant amount of travel. It's a red dwarf star, twice as old as our sun, about 10 billion years old. Now, in the past, people thought they had detected a planet there, but it turned out to be a mistake. There'd been periodic maintenance on their Discoverer's, at that time, telescope, which had actually caused the erroneous readings. However, scientists have been looking through two or three decades of data on the path of taken by Barnard's star, and they've detected a slight wobble in that path. It's not a straight line, it's a little wavy line, and that's caused by the mass of this super Earth planet that is rotating, orbiting around the star. They believe it's three times the mass of our planet Earth, but they are 99% sure of its existence. So that's pretty close.
Good, yeah.
Yeah. It's an icy world. They know where it would be and the heat given out by this star. So it would be about minus 100, so not suitable for life, unless by chance it has an atmosphere that is thick enough for liquid water to exist. But a great target for a future interstellar mission once mankind develops that kind of technology. Now, talking of stars and discoveries, again within the last month, it's been announced that the oldest star to ever be discovered has just been identified. It's a tiny star, only 14% the mass of our sun. Now, I said that Barnard's star was 10 million billion years old and twice as old as our star. This one is 13.5 billion years old. And given that we think that the Big Bang was 14.7, is it, billion years ago, that's fairly close. So it's thought to be just one generation away from the very first stars that formed from the hydrogen that would have been created at the Big Bang. So this particular star's got hardly any heavy elements. It just comprises hydrogen, helium, a little lithium. Whereas some of the heavier elements, like carbon, silicon, iron, you know, our sun has got lots of that. It's got 14 times the mass of our biggest planet, Jupiter, of heavy elements within our sun. Now, this tiny little star has only got about our planet's Mercury's mass of heavy elements. So another exciting new discovery. Talking of discoveries, Europe can hold its head up well with a fantastic European Space Agency mission called Gaia. Again, there's a heavy British involvement in this. I think it was Stevenage or possibly Swindon, forgive me. But certainly the chip in the camera is British made. Now, this satellite is in Earth orbit, but it's measuring the position and motion of stars in incredible detail, very, very fine detail. This chip is so sensitive in this camera that they use that it can measure the width of a human hair in New York from London. So that shows you the accuracy. Shows you the accuracy. So it needs that kind of accuracy to identify the motion of stars. And it's just discovered that there's a whole bunch of several thousand stars in the Milky Way whose direction of movement is opposite to that of the rest of the Milky Way. And these stars seem also to be of what we call a slightly different spectral type. So this population of stars seem to be much the same and going in a different direction. So the theory is that this is the results of one of several collisions that our Milky Way has had with a smaller but still fairly sizable other galaxy, probably 10 billion years or so ago. We've already known that our galaxy has collided with others in the past, and that's the end of our galaxy will be much like that. You've probably heard of the Andromeda galaxy.
Yes.
And that and our Milky Way are tearing at each other at a huge rate of knots, and in about 5 billion years they're going to merge. They'll go through each other, out again, and bounce and gradually coalesce into one.
Will there be a lot of collisions within all?
No, because the stars are so far apart that it's not thought any stars are going to bang into each other at all.
Oh, really?
What will happen is the gases in the stars will collide. So a star will collide with gas will collide with gas. And at those speeds and at those temperatures, new stars will be formed as a result of those collisions.
Okay. We won't be around to see that, though, will we?
No. Gaia has also come up with another discovery. I've mentioned about galaxy collisions, but we also have satellite galaxies around the Milky Way. Lots of them, small ones. The two biggest ones are probably quite well known to some of our listeners who might have been down in the southern hemisphere, because we have something called the Magellanic Clouds, named by Magellan, when he was exploring the southern hemisphere. So there's the large and the small Magellanic Clouds. If only we could see them from the UK. But something that's about the same size as the large Magellanic Cloud has just been discovered. Now, why wasn't it discovered before if it's that big? Well, two reasons. It's hidden from us by the disk of the Milky Way. It's exactly the other side of the Milky Way from where we are. But the other thing is, it's about 10,000 times fainter than the Magellanic Cloud. So the reason for this seems to be that it's got hardly any stars left in it. They've all been many of them will have been attracted into our Milky Way by Milky Way's gravity. But the outline of the galaxy is still there. There are still enough stars there to make it a separate galaxy. And they've given it the name Antlia 2. So it's a ghost galaxy, if you like, and it's about 130,000 light years away. But it's only just been discovered, and it's still a bit of a mystery as to why it hasn't shrunk, why it's kept its size. So that's it, Graham. That's my review of what has interested me over the last month or so.
A fascinating month indeed, John. Stars Over Surrey, Constellation of the Month. So, John, then, what's the Constellation of the Month?
Okay, Graham, well, in the last few months we've had some related constellations, related in terms of Greek mythology, that's the basis of so many of our star shapes up in the sky. We've had Pegasus, the winged horse, and the lady that the winged horse and the hero went to rescue, Andromeda. We've had Cassiopeia, who is Andromeda's mother. And so now it's the hero. It's Perseus. So Perseus is nicely placed, almost overhead, so easy to find, and just lay back in a deck chair or something like that, a lounger with a pair of binoculars, and trace out the stars. There's some messier objects in there to be found if you've got a good telescope. So more on that in the set of slides and, of course, on the website.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey. So, what's happening in the month ahead, John?
Okay, well, we're tending to lose our summer constellations, but things like Lyra and the constellation and Vega, the main star of the constellation Lyra, are still there towards the northwest in the evening, and Cygnus nearby with Deneb, its main star, and that wonderful double star Albireo, still available for the early evening, but then will sink out of sight. I've already mentioned that Pegasus is still up, and Cassiopeia, and of course our constellation of the month, Perseus, But what we've got coming up in the southeast now is something that's going to attract a lot of attention, and that's the constellation of Orion. So it's probably the most recognisable constellation in the sky, I would think. And for me, the most interesting part is the nebula, which is in the sword of Orion, which dangles down just below the three stars that make up his belt. So that's a stellar nursery. Stars are being created there as we speak. Other constellations around of note, we'll have Canis Major with Sirius, the dog star that the belt stars of Orion point to. That's up there. Together with a little bit higher up, we'll have Auriga with some wonderful open clusters in. And, of course, Gemini, the twins. If you're interested in looking at the moon, then the best time to study the moon would be about the 14th of December, a few days either side, when it is at first quarter. If you're more interested in looking at fainter objects in the sky, then do that around the early part of the month, because it's new moon on the 4th. Full moon... So an awful lot of light pollution around caused by the full moon. That's on the 22nd. So in terms of planets, I'm afraid that it's mostly going to have to be early mornings for you if you want to see some planets. Both Mercury and Venus are there before sunrise. So Mercury is well placed, brightening quite considerably as the month progresses, rising 2 hours before the sunrise at the in the middle of the month, but just about an hour before sunrise by the end. It's also quite close to another planet, which I'll tell you about in just a few moments, help you to find it. Venus rises earlier, about 4 hours before sunrise. That's absolutely brilliant, so you can't miss that. And if you have a telescope, then do point it at Venus, because it shows phases just like the moon does. That's because it's between the Earth and the Sun. So it'll show a crescent phase at the start of the month, but a half phase by the end of December. Mars is our only naked eye planet that's available in the evening. Good object in the southern to southwestern skies during the month. Pinkish red in colour and relatively bright means it's easily identifiable. It is fainter than it was several months ago, but it's higher in the sky. Jupiter is a bright morning object, low in the southeast, so again that rises about an hour or so before the sun. So bright, again, easy to find, but not quite as bright as Venus. Saturn, sadly, effectively lost to us this month. And if you have a good telescope and good star maps and know how to use them to find a planet, then Uranus and Neptune are both visible. Uranus particularly well placed in the constellation of Pisces. There's quite a few events in December, a couple of meteor showers. So let's start off with the 3rd. I like to... tell you when the moon is near a planet, because everybody can find the moon and you might not be sure whether that's a planet you're looking at as a star. So find the moon on the 3rd, and a very bright star-like object near it will be Venus, but that's 5 o'clock in the morning. On the 3rd, it actually forms a right-angled triangle with a bright star called Speaker, which is the main star of the constellation Virgo. So it's Alpha Virginis. So look for that right-angled triangle in the morning of the 3rd, and you'll identify not just a planet, Venus, but the name of a particular star, Speaker. The moon will still be close, of course, to Venus the following day. It'll only be 6 degrees, but further to the west of Venus. Now, Mars is going to be very close to the planet Neptune. on the 7th. So you could only see this with a telescope, mind you. You'll see Mars naked eye. But if you can find Mars on the 7th in the evening, in the southwest, then get a telescope on it, and just below and to the right, you'll see something, and that is the planet Neptune. It should show, hopefully, a sort of bluish-greenish colour. And it won't be twinkling like a star would, because it's a small disk is what you're actually seeing. Now, we've got a comet coming up that's faint at the moment, but brightening. It's a comet that's been around for quite a few years. It was discovered in 48, I think, and it's called Comet 46P Wirtanen. Now, on the 12th, it's at its closest to the Sun, perihelion, we call it. So that's when it will really start heating up, and the volatiles on its surface will start flowing off under the pressure of the solar wind, so it will be developing more of a tail. So in the slides that support this program, you'll find a star map, a finder chart that plots the path of the comet against the background stars, and that's down at daily intervals. So as we go through December, you'll see that it's passing through Taurus, for example, the bull. So quite easy constellation to find, not that far from Orion, and hopefully a pair of binoculars will reveal Comet Wirtanen to you. It'll look as like a fuzzy greenish ball, perhaps with a small tail. And astronomers are thinking it might get bright enough to be naked eye visible. But certainly, good pair of binoculars will show it. Mars is near the Moon on the 13th, so a nice reddish pink object about 5 degrees above the Moon. That's Mars. Now, there is, on the same day, later in the evening, the 13th, the Geminids meteor shower. So that's the peak is the late on the 13th, the early hours of the 14th. Probably better in the morning, but late evening will be good enough. Wait until the Moon has set so that you won't get the light of the Moon washing out the fainter meteors. Now, on the 20th to the 22nd, the mornings of all of those days, you'll find Mercury and Jupiter very close together, only about 2 moons' widths, 1 degree apart. So to start with, Jupiter will be on one side of Mercury, it'll travel past Mercury, and then it'll be the other side of Mercury. But look on those mornings about an hour before sunrise, and hopefully you'll be able to see 2 planets within your a pair of binoculars field of view. On the 21st, the Moon goes through the constellation Taurus, in part of the constellation of Taurus is a V-shaped cluster called the Hyades, and that's a big, wide V in the sky. And the Moon will be right in the middle of this cluster at 5 o'clock in the morning. There's another smaller meteor shower the following night, the 22nd, but there aren't that many meteors, but more than the average night you might see. The Moon can also be your guide to find perhaps what might be your first of the Messier objects, if you haven't seen any before. The Messier objects are a catalogue, an M44, the Beehive Cluster, or its proper name is Praesepe, but the Beehive Cluster, I think, sums it up quite nicely. A swarm of bees round a hide, faint stars, but visible in a pair of binoculars. The Moon will be only 1 degree below that little cluster on Christmas Day in the morning. Now, one thing I don't think I've mentioned over the last few months is to remind people about a very good website they might find of interest. If they're interested in seeing the International Space Station go over, remember with the crew on board, the website is called Heavens Above. So you just need to put a hyphen in between heavens, hyphen above, www.mars.com. Now, that will come up with a page, the home page. You need to select your location, which you can do from the top right of that website, and then you'll get a, and then select what you want to see. And if you select ISS visible passes, it'll show you things such as I've got in front of me a list of passes for the first week in December. So on 1st of December, for example, there'll be a wonderful pass at about 10 to 6. It'll start at 9 minutes to 6, in fact. The space station will rise in the west-southwest. It'll get to almost vertical in the south about 3 minutes later, and then it'll disappear at that point as it goes into the Earth's shadow. But that will be about as bright as Venus gets. And so it's passes like that that you can see most in many days, sometimes in the morning, sometimes in the evening. But find out where to look and at what time to look for your particular location from heavens above. There's something else you could look for called an iridium flare. The iridium set of satellites are telecommunication satellites for mobile phone. Now, they have got very, very large solar panels. And as those solar panels reflect the sun's light, sometimes they reflect it down to Earth. So you get like a flash that you'd get from a mirror catching the sun. And these can be very, very bright indeed. For example, on December the 1st, Saturday, December the 1st, there's going to be one that's even brighter than Venus ever gets. And that will be about 44 degrees in the high in the northeast. And that's from the Iridium 14 satellite. And that will be at 5:26 in the morning. So that website will show you when these iridium flares happen. Now, if you're interested in seeing these, do it before too long, because those satellites are being replaced. You know, they're going to eventually burn up, but they're being replaced by a new generation of iridium satellites with smaller panels, and they won't have this big, bright flash that you can see in up in the sky. Okay, so meetings at local societies. And Guildford Astronomical Society, the one I usually start, gotten quite important for this area, Graham, because here we are at Brooklands Radio in Weybridge, and our speaker that night, Dr. Colin McGill, who is a Guildford Society member, actually lives here in Weybridge. Now, Colin did his PhD in theoretical astrophysics at Oxford University, where he continued as a professional astronomer. And also worked at the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics. Now, he's going to do a two-part talk, the second part being in January, and this is on cosmology. So on the 6th of December at 7:30 at Lecture Theatre L at the Uni of Surrey, it's Cosmology Part 1. Now, it's going to be particularly good, I think, because in the past, sometimes our academic speakers have, I think, sometimes forgotten they are not talking to other academics. And sometimes it's been a little bit over the head of some of our members, me included. But Colin knows well the sort of level of people in the Astronomical Society and the visitors who attend meetings. So it will be pitched just right, I'm sure. He's a splendid guy. He continues as an astronomer. He's got his own observatory over in Spain that he operates remotely from here in Weybridge. Now, moving on to other societies, most of them, I'm afraid, have got closed meetings because it's their AGM. So that's the true for Farnham Astronomical Society, Croydon Astronomical Society, and also at Yule. They're closed too. However, we have got a meeting that should interest our listeners on Wednesday the 19th of December at the Department of Physics at the University of Surrey. It's one of their monthly astronomy evenings that they now run over the winter. So that will be in Lecture Theatre D. There will be a talk. Unfortunately, they haven't yet given me the title or the speaker, but it will be on an appropriate topic. And then, if clear, stargazing at their little observatory they have there. If it's not clear, then it will be a talk about the night sky. Now, this is a free event, but because the size of their observatory isn't that big, so they have to stage people in and out, they do need to know how many people. So you do have to book for this via the University of Surrey's website. So go on to, you can Google that, and go on to the Department of Physics pages and find events, and you'll get linked to the Eventbrite booking for that. So for some armchair astronomy that we can do, watching the telly on the sky at night on the 9th of December at 10 o'clock, that's BBC 4, and repeated at 7:30, also BBC 4, on Thursday the 13th, that's Telescope on a Plane. The team looks at SOFIA. That's a 17-ton telescope mounted on a Boeing 747SP. And SOFIA observes our galaxy from about 12 kilometres high, and it can peer through the cosmic dust into the heart of the Milky Way to see how stars form. And so Chris Lintott is leading that expedition on board that Boeing 747, talking to the scientists about how they operate. Because I wouldn't fancy opening a door in a plane at that sort of height, but clearly they've thought of that and how it works, and all of that will be explained on that programme. And that concludes my What's Up.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you for a really fascinating insight this month. And the show is going to be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. It is available after transmission as a podcast, and the podcast also has some items that we couldn't fit into the broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be on Friday, the 28th of December at 7:20 p.m.
Stars Over Surrey, the monthly guide to the night sky.